loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. In our first hour, we take a look at two major stories. First, John Bolton made a major speech in Miami, a fiery, militant, counter-revolutionary speech denouncing what he called the troika of tyranny that would be Cuba, Venezuela, and Nicaragua, the governments of those countries. He also praised the far-right, perhaps fascist, new president-elect of Brazil, Bolsonaro. We're going to talk about what that speech means with Max Blumenthal. And then today we take a look, as we do every Friday, at the political races around the country in the run-up to the midterm elections next week.
But before we get to those stories, we'll go over today's headlines, including five that we'll cover in depth in the second hour. First, Senate Judiciary Committee Chairman Chuck Grassley, a Republican of Iowa, announced yesterday that for 4 years during the Obama administration, the CIA intercepted the emails of potential intelligence community whistleblowers and the emails of the Senate Intelligence and Judiciary Committees. Grassley said that he had known this was happening for 4 years, but the information was classified. It was finally declassified at his request last week. Grassley blames former CIA Director John Brennan and former Director of National Intelligence James Clapper by name for what appears to be an overtly illegal act. Next, President Trump offered remarks yesterday evening about immigration and the thousands of troops he's sending to the border. He said he hopes the military doesn't have to shoot, but he told reporters that he has told the military that if any migrants seeking asylum throw any rocks, that the military should consider the rock to be a rifle. Then, U.S. sanctions against Iran will take effect on Monday, 6 months after the Trump administration withdrew from the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or Iran trade deal. The question, though, is what other countries will do about the sanctions and whether any waivers will make a difference. And then just hours after President Trump and Chinese President Xi Jinping had a positive phone call that pointed to an improvement in diplomatic relations, the Department of Justice issued indictments against two Chinese companies and three Chinese individuals yesterday for allegedly stealing trade secrets. What's behind the mixed signals coming from the U.S. government? And finally, it's Friday, so we will look at the week's worst, funniest, and most misleading headlines. And in other headlines, an advisor to Turkish President Erdogan revealed today that the body of murdered Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi was dissolved in acid. Jamal Akte told the Turkish newspaper, quote, "The reason they dismembered Khashoggi's body was to dissolve his remains more easily. Now we see that they did not only dismember his body, but they also vaporized it," unquote. The killing of Khashoggi has led to a major diplomatic crisis for the Saudi regime. The trial about Harvard's admission policy comes to an end today. During the questioning, Harvard acknowledged that Asian American applicants do in fact receive lower personal ratings than other racial groups. The trial will be decided by a judge without a jury, and the closing arguments finish today. Cesar Sayoc, the man accused of sending 15 pipe bombs to various high-ranking Democratic officials nationwide, as well as to CNN, appeared in court today and agreed to be transferred to New York. He faces up to 45 years in prison if convicted. The Saudi-led military coalition waging war on Yemen has carried out airstrikes against Sana'a International Airport, a facility held by the Houthi rebels. The coalition claimed the airport was being used for military activities. This attack on a high-profile piece of civilian infrastructure comes despite calls from Secretary of Defense Mattis and Secretary of State Pompeo, both of whom had been enthusiastic backers of the Yemen war, for a ceasefire. Those are today's headlines. You're listening to Loud and Clear.
Loud and Clear.
Now we turn to the speech given by National Security Advisor John Bolton. He gave a militantly counter-revolutionary speech in Miami yesterday, declaring the existence of what he called a troika of tyranny, close quote, in Latin America that would be Cuba, Venezuela, and Nicaragua. Bolton also pledged support for the far-right Brazilian president-elect Jair Bolsonaro, who made several bold announcements yesterday. Since the election, Bolsonaro said that he would move Brazil's embassy in Israel to Jerusalem, that he would merge the environment and agriculture ministries threatening the Amazon, and that he would name the prosecutor of former President Lula da Silva as the new Minister of Justice. We're joined from Washington, D.C. by Max Blumenthal. Max is a journalist, a best-selling author whose latest book is The 51-Day War, Ruin and Resistance in Gaza. He is also the senior editor of Gray Zone Project and the co-host of the podcast Moderate Rebels. Max, welcome back.
Great to be on with you.
Isn't it great to have John Bolton back in government? Isn't it great? I mean, this is an amazing speech, the Troika of Tyranny. He's a poet. Max, let me just ask you, does it augur anything new in terms of U.S. policy? Is this the rollout of a new policy towards Cuba, Venezuela, Nicaragua, or just a rhetorical flourish on top of the already existing policy?
Well, I saw that a number of anti-Trump liberals were really angry with the Troika of Tyranny designation on Twitter because Bolton resorted to the use of a Russian word. So for them, this was proof of Russian collusion.
That's funny. We were in our editorial meeting here at Sputnik. Some of the people who work here who are Russian speakers said, "We didn't know you guys even knew the word Troika. We thought you just like knew Nyet and Sputnik."
Yeah. Bolton apparently does have a rich and deep appreciation of Russian culture. Either that or he has a sort of preoccupation with the Cold War. And, you know, this speech was really so 80s to me. It was a very retro speech. You know, I could hear synth drums in the background. I could see kind of like guys wearing no socks and Miami Vice suits in the crowd. Actually, Bolton was speaking at Freedom Tower in Miami. This was a speech directly addressed to the Miami lobby. Trump wants to carry Florida. There's a governor's race, DeSantis, who's Trump's handpicked candidate, versus Andrew Gillum. And, you know, that was a factor in this speech, as well as the 2020 elections. You know, Trump carried Florida against Hillary Clinton. So there are domestic politics at play as usual. But what this speech really represented to me, and I actually haven't watched the entire thing, but I read some of the transcript, really is an intensification of Trump's policy toward Latin America. John Bolton is really driving this policy. And John Bolton comes out of AEI, the American Enterprise Institute, which is like the hive of neocons in Washington. Who else is at AEI is Roger Noriega, who is John Bolton's colleague in the Bush administration, who is a, you know, Cuban-American extreme right winger who actually had boasted of an attempt to cause chaos in Cuba in 2012 and to create the context for a coup in Cuba. That was recently when he was out of government. I mean, these are real renegade figures. Roger Noriega just published an editorial in the Miami Herald ahead of Bolton's speech, which kind of laid out the agenda that he wanted Bolton to put on the table. And it's clear that Noriega is involved here. And what he called for, I thought one of the most disturbing things he called for, is to appoint somebody to oversee a contingency plan for a military invasion or some military action in Venezuela if the government collapses under economic sanctions. And so basically what they want to do, or what Noriega was signaling, is what they want to do is what Kissinger said he wanted to do to the Chilean economy under Allende: make the economy scream, cause a massive refugee outflow to Colombia, then declare that the region is becoming destabilized and that they have to go in, and therefore, they need a contingency plan. Noriega named a figure, William Brownfield, who I can talk about a little bit more later on. He was a former anti-narcotics official under Obama and through some of Trump's tenure. And he also was the U.S. ambassador to Caracas in Venezuela. He was involved in a lot of intrigue against the Maduro government. And Noriega called for Brownfield to be rehired to oversee this contingency plan. And I believe Nuevo País just reported that Brownfield was hired in the immediate wake of Bolton's speech. I would need to confirm that. I haven't seen it in English language media, but that's a really disturbing sign that there is some planning going on for a military invasion of Venezuela in the wake of Jair Bolsonaro's election in Brazil.
Yeah, we're talking with Max Blumenthal. Max joins us from Washington, D.C. Max is a journalist. He's a best-selling author. His latest book is The 51-Day War, Ruin and Resistance in Gaza. He also, with Dan Cohen, made the movie Killing Gaza. Max, before we end this episode, this segment, I want to ask you to tell people how people can find that excellent movie about Gaza. Max is also the senior editor of Gray Zone Project and the co-host of the podcast, moderate rebels. Max, I want to play a couple audio clips from John Bolton's speech about the Troika of Tyranny that he gave in Miami. The first clip is short. The second clip is about 34 seconds. The first clip is about 10 seconds. We'll hear that. We have a third audio clip, but I want to start with the first two and then get your reaction.
The Troika of Tyranny in this hemisphere, Cuba, Venezuela, and Nicaragua, has finally met its match.
Yay. Okay, that's strong. A little cheerleading there. Let's hear the second clip.
The United States now looks forward to watching each corner of the triangle fall in Havana, in Caracas, in Managua. While we await that fateful day, the people of the region can be assured that the United States stands with them against the forces of oppression, totalitarianism, and domination. Look to the north. Look to our flag. Look to your own. The Troika will crumble. The people will triumph. And the righteous flame of freedom will burn brightly again in this hemisphere. Thank you very much.
The righteous flame of freedom will burn, Max, once again. Of course, America's goals in Latin America are noble. They're not exploitative. They're not about domination. They're about freedom.
Yeah, we're going to export some freedom fries. You know, when you hear Bolton, when you read Bolton in print, it sounds so fearsome. And then when you hear him deliver it, it sounds kind of like a librarian translating for Darth Vader or something. He just doesn't carry the same weight in person. So I probably should have listened to him.
I'm going to play another audio clip so you can enjoy a little bit more. Let's listen to one more. Here's John Bolton, librarian, reading a Darth Vader script.
We're working hard to strengthen bonds and deepen ties with several responsible governments throughout the region. The United States is thrilled to be partnering with nations such as Mexico, Colombia, Brazil, Argentina, and many others to advance the rule of law and increase security and prosperity for our people. The recent elections of like-minded leaders in key countries, including Ivan Duque in Colombia and last weekend Jair Bolsonaro in Brazil, are positive signs for the future of the region and demonstrate a growing regional commitment to free market principles and open, transparent, and accountable governance.
I think John Foster Dulles made a speech like this when Hitler became chancellor in Germany in 1933. Max, go ahead.
Well, yeah, the comments about Bolsonaro are particularly jarring, given that Bolsonaro's own comments have called for basically depriving Brazilian indigenous people of all land, smashing the landless workers movement, extreme anti-gay comments saying that he would rather his son be dead than be gay. Bolsonaro's own son had called for a military coup. His father didn't win the election. His father has said that, you know, the problem with the military junta in Brazil was that they tortured and they didn't kill enough. And then here you have John Bolton basically celebrating the election of Bolsonaro as the real pivot that the U.S. had been seeking against the pink tide, the kind of democratic socialist movement that had swept across South America, and also to attack Nicaragua and Central America. Nicaragua hadn't really been targeted this publicly by the U.S. The government of Daniel Ortega, which is a popularly elected government, has just faced down a coup. I did a lot of coverage of that coup. I was there in July as the last roadblocks were removed. And that had cost the country $500 million. Nicaragua was doing really well economically. It was growing at 4 to 5% a year. Now growth is at about 0%. And the population of Nicaragua really wants to return to just some degree of stability. There isn't a lot of momentum for overthrowing the government there, but you can hear with Bolton that they want to kickstart the regime change process again. There have been some sanctions against Nicaragua in the past, but now you see the NECA Act advancing through Congress. It's really the baby of Ileana Ross Leighton, who's another Cuban American from the Miami lobby who represents their interests in Congress, and it would effectively put Nicaragua under the kind of embargo it was in the 1980s. When 50,000 or so Nicaraguans died, then you have in the background of all of this, the hysteria that Trump has stoked about the caravan, which I think has contributed to the kind of domestic violence and the wave of right-wing domestic terrorism we've seen. And Nicaragua is the rare country in Central America that hasn't contributed to the migration crisis, or didn't until this coup, which was backed strongly by the U.S. and by U.S.-backed civil society groups through the National Endowment for Democracy, hit that country and destabilized it. Bolton's agenda is extremely destabilizing for Latin America, deliberately so. He does aim to encourage an intensification of the refugee population outflow from Venezuela to Colombia. The U.S. is investing a lot of military and diplomatic infrastructure on the Colombian border of Venezuela, just as it did on the Turkish border of Syria when it sought regime change against Damascus. So this is, you know, this is an ominous prospect. It begins not only with economic warfare, but also with psychological warfare. So I can point to two things the U.S. has done recently as part of a psychological campaign against Venezuela. The first is to leak details of meetings that the Trump administration has carried out with figures within the Venezuelan military as they sought to encourage a coup d'etat from within the military. They leaked that to the New York Times. This was to kind of cause anxiety and divisions within Maduro's inner circle. I had mentioned William Brownfield before, the former U.S. ambassador to Caracas. Bloomberg reported, I think 2 months ago, that Brownfield oversaw a scheme to sanction basically everyone in Maduro's inner circle except for one figure whose name I forget. And the point was to create suspicion in Maduro's camp that that official, because he wasn't sanctioned, was actually a CIA asset. So this is the kind of subterfuge and deception that the U.S. is deploying, and we can expect that to intensify. And then, you know, the ultimate plan is that the instability generated by this pressure cooker effect around Venezuela will lead to create the context for the pretext for a military intervention. And it appears that they already have a contingency plan for that. Once Venezuela falls, the Trump administration and the Miami lobby believes that Cuba and Nicaragua will be left so vulnerable that they'll be easy prey.
Max Blumenthal is our guest. Max, I want to unpack the definition of tyranny. Troika, again, for the non-Russian speaker, means it's like the Father, Son, and the Holy Ghost, not the trilogy, but the troika, the three. But, you know, troika of tyranny. In Nicaragua, there was a tyranny. It was under Somoza. There was a dictator. I mean, it was a real tyranny. The Sandinistas led a long armed struggle to overthrow the tyranny of the Somoza dictatorship that was completely backed by the United States. In the case of Cuba, there was a tyranny. It was the Batista dictatorship that was completely backed by the United States. But when you actually had these anti-people dictatorships in both those countries, the United States was not unhappy. The United States government policy was very happy. It only became unhappy and began to target those countries when the actual tyranny was overthrown. I wanted to bring it out because I think a lot of younger people especially don't know the history of Nicaragua and don't know the history of Cuba. They hear things about the Sandinistas maybe recently with this NED, National Endowment of Democracy-backed attempted coup d'etat, or the constant echo chamber of the U.S. media demonizing Fidel Castro or Raul Castro or the Cuban Revolution, but they don't know what actually came before it. Those revolutions broke free from tyranny. Help the audience understand a little bit about Nicaragua, because you were there and you know a great deal about that history.
Well, you know, Nicaragua's history is not terribly different from Cuba's, and Venezuela shares a sort of a similar history and a similar tradition. And the Sandinistas, you know, who control the government or most factions within the government in Nicaragua, really represent a 2 to 3 million strong progressive anti-imperialist workers movement that has been an inspiration to people across Latin America, which is why Nicaragua is seen as a threat, even though it operates as a kind of mixed economy. You don't get the sense that you're in a, you know, strongly Marxist socialist country when you're there, as you do when you're in Cuba and you don't see advertising in the streets and you see these public cooperatives. Nicaragua's it's a mixed economy. It's not able to operate on heavily ideological lines because it doesn't have the backing of the Soviet Union anymore. But the Sandinistas are there and they're very strong. The Sandinista movement defeated Anastasio Somoza, who was a brutal and ruthless dictator who ruled for decades on behalf of the U.S., basically to enforce the interests of the United Fruit Company and, you know, American corporate interests. The U.S. had defeated Jacobo Arbenz, who was a democratic socialist figure in Guatemala, through a coup and psychological warfare. And basically what we saw take place in Guatemala was decades of civil war, tens of thousands dead, tens of thousands tortured, and a country that's at a point where it's completely destabilized and it's controlled now by a right-wing reality TV show star, which should sound familiar to Americans. It's a terrible situation. Guatemalans exist off remittances, whereas Nicaragua's economy is fairly strong. There are anti-poverty programs that have, you know, wiped out malnutrition and wiped out illiteracy in the countryside. The government of Daniel Ortega has been in power for about 12 years. It was elected again in 2006 after leaving power in 1990. And they have really embarked on a strong anti-poverty crusade across the country with very limited resources in the second poorest country in the Western Hemisphere. And I was in Nicaragua before 2006 when it was under the control of a neoliberal technocrat who had no anti-poverty programs. And since I returned, I've seen roads where there were no roads before, electricity where people were getting 2 to 4 hours of electricity a day, water where people, full-time water, when people would just wait around with buckets for the water to come on for an hour a day because the previous government had privatized the water and sold it to a Spanish company. So this is why when Nicaragua faced this kind of soft coup, color revolution attempt, so many people came out in the streets and mobilized to defend their government because they had benefited so much from it. And we're seeing the same thing in Venezuela, although the economy is in a much worse condition. There is still a mass popular mobilization in support of that government. And I've spent time in Cuba, where another tyrant backed by the U.S., Fulgencio Batista, was overthrown by Fidel Castro and a band of guerrillas who are supported by the campesinos in the countryside. And, you know, people in Cuba, they would like more freedom. That was the sense I got. They would like more access to the internet, which is actually hard to get because of the embargo. But what they would most like is for the embargo to end so socialism could flourish. There really didn't seem to be a popular will for toppling their government. And you can understand why if you go to the eastern edge of Cuba and you go to Santiago, which is where a lot of the Afro-Cuban population lives, and you can stand on a hill in Santiago and look out from that hill and see Haiti. Haiti is a country that it was the first democratic country in the Western Hemisphere, the product of a massive slave revolt against Napoleon, which still is indebted to France. And this country has been ravaged by the United States. Haiti attempted to do what Cuba, Venezuela, Nicaragua had done and swept with the Lavalas movement, which was the Haitian version of the Sandinistas. Lavalas means wave, swept into power a liberation theology preacher named Jean-Bertrand Aristide. And he was immediately removed in a coup by U.S. trained military personnel trained at the School of the Americas. And the Clinton administration made a deal with Aristide. We will return you to power if you agree to massive free trade agreements. Basically, Aristide was returned to power. Haiti's domestic rice economy was wiped out and was as they were forced to import rice from Louisiana and Arkansas. And Aristide was weakened year after year by sanctions from the U.S. Congress until he faced another coup in 2004 that was directly overseen by the U.S. government through the National Endowment for Democracy. And since then, Haiti has been in a state of complete chaos, instability, and now exists under another kind of U.S.-backed tyranny. So what John Bolton is basically calling for the region is for all of these countries to exist under the tyranny of the United States the United States towards Latin America has been the ultimate tyrant. And we're not only moving back to the Cold War, we're returning to the Monroe Doctrine. Unfortunately for John Bolton and for, I mean, this is a bipartisan project. For anyone in Washington who wants to dominate Latin America, there are new forces in the world that can actually counter American hegemony, specifically with China. And so what we're actually witnessing is a power play by the U.S. to keep China out of these countries, as it's doing in Africa. And I think it's ultimately, while we're seeing a right-wing tide right now, I think ultimately people in Latin America are going to continue to seek alternatives to U.S. tyranny, and they will turn east if necessary.
Max Blumenthal is our guest. Max is the senior editor at Gray Zone Project. I was looking at your Twitter feed, and people who want to follow you can at Max Blumenthal can do that. This is about, and I think you're either retweeting or replying to Ben Norton, also with the Gray Zone Project. The U.S., EU, NATO-funded Atlantic Council deleted its tweet discussing steps fascist Bolsonaro should now undertake to deliver on campaign promises as Brazilians' hopes high. That's from the Atlantic Council. We've talked about the Atlantic Council before. The Atlantic Council is, I guess, now they're a little bit embarrassed. They took the tweet down, but they're supporting Bolsonaro, the fascist.
Yeah, I mean, that's not unique. The Atlantic Council is basically NATO's think tank in Washington. So it represents a Western military hegemony. Colombia has already applied for NATO membership or NATO status. And I think Brazil might do the same under Bolsonaro. So it's not surprising that the Atlantic Council would be excited about his victory. But then you also have the fact that this think tank is funded by a who's who of corporate America. Especially the extraction industry. And, you know, corporate America is extremely excited about Bolsonaro's victory. They can't contain their enthusiasm, although they'd like to, because he has spouted so much fascist rhetoric. So the Atlantic Council's tweet really represented how the kind of mainline think tanks in Washington, which are funded by ExxonMobil and the arms industry, feel. And there's also going to be an enormous intensification of military cooperation between the U.S. and Brazil. So I basically called them out on Twitter and I said, you know, they're talking about, you know, high hopes for Brazil and they're offering their own advice on how Bolsonaro can fulfill his campaign promises. I mean, I think he'd called for basically smashing socialism. So that's one promise they can help him fulfill.
And cutting down the Amazon.
Yeah. And basically just destroying the lungs of the world. It's great. These are really heartwarming promises. And this really exposed what the Atlantic Council's agenda is and the agenda of everything they represent. And they deleted the tweet. It was amazing. I mean, they were ashamed. And they attempted to explain to Ben Norton, my colleague, what they really thought about Bolsonaro in a blog post. But I thought, you know, this really said it all. They thought they could have kind of a closed door meeting where, you know, a bunch of elites and insiders celebrated Bolsonaro and talked about their plans for ravaging Brazil's public sector and environment. And instead, somebody noticed on Twitter and they got basically ratioed by all sorts of people who are concerned about Brazil. And that, to me, it was sort of a signal moment. There is a lot of discomfort in Washington about Bolsonaro because he came out of nowhere. He was a right-wing kind of backbencher for 27 years who was known for clownish rhetoric. A lot of Brazilians told me they hadn't heard of him until there was this massive social media campaign that included a lot of fake news to promote him. And then all of a sudden, you know, Washington falls in love with him, but they're uncomfortable about his public image. And so I think there's a lot of there are opportunities here for those of us who are concerned about the direction of Latin America to continue to spread the shame in Washington for foisting this figure on Brazil. And I think Brazilians will become ashamed when he starts to come for their pensions and starts to take away a lot of the benefits that they've come to count on. So I wouldn't count on Bolsonaro having an easy ride, and the people in Washington behind him shouldn't either.
We've been joined from Washington, D.C. by Max Blumenthal. Max is a journalist. He's a best-selling author. His latest book is The 51-Day War, Ruin and Resistance in Gaza. Along with Dan Cohen, Max is the co-producer of the film Killing Gaza. Max, real quick, how can people get that movie?
KillingGaza.com. You can rent it for $3 or view it and have it. Hold it for $5.
Please see that movie. Max is also the senior editor of Gray Zone Project, the co-host of the podcast, Moderate Rebels. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay with us.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou in studio with my co-host Brian Becker. Again today, we take a look at political races around the country in the run-up to midterm elections. We are joined from Washington by Jacqueline Lukman. She is the co-editor-in-chief of Lukman Nation, and you can check out their live stream every Thursday night at 9 p.m. on Facebook. Welcome, Jackie.
Thanks for having me.
Jackie, here we are just a few days out from the midterm elections. This is something we've been waiting for what, a year? I guess we've been doing this segment. And I have to say, it's come to crunch time. There are so many races that are so close that it's almost impossible to predict an outcome. With that said, we're going to do exactly that. I want to talk first in general. There was a piece that the Associated Press ran this week. And it's entitled House Democrats Poised to Wage War on Trump with a Weapon the GOP Created to Undermine Obama. And what this says is that the Republicans gave themselves the right to issue subpoenas at the committee level without consulting the minority party. Now, for 240 years of the existence of our great republic, the two parties, or however many parties there were at whatever given point in history, in order to issue a subpoena, the two parties consulted with each other and they issued the subpoena jointly. And that way you didn't have witch hunts. Well, the Republicans changed that rule just a couple of years ago. They did it on the House side, not the Senate side. And so the rule since 2015 has been that any committee chairman can issue a subpoena without consulting the minority party. It looks like the Democrats are going to win the House of Representatives, and that means it's time for investigations. I just wanted to point that out, that it's going to be, if the Democrats win the House of Representatives on Tuesday, things are going to get mighty ugly. So with that said, let's start looking at some of these races. Oprah Winfrey was in Georgia, literally knocking on people's doors and asking them to vote in the gubernatorial election, which frankly is one of the closest in the country. And this is the race that we were talking about, where the current Georgia Secretary of State, Brian Kemp, the Republican who's running for governor, has been actively suppressing votes. And it got so bad that this week, Jimmy Carter, former President Jimmy Carter, who is now 94 years old, released a letter, sent it to the Associated Press, urging Kemp to resign as Secretary of State, saying that you can't be in charge of the election and be running for governor at the same time. Now, you and I have been saying that since the issue first arose. Now, Oprah Winfrey is in Georgia trying to get out the vote for the Democratic candidate, State Senator Abrams. We've talked about her at length. And Oprah's been going door to door, like literally knocking on doors. People are freaking out. And it might seem funny on the surface of things, but CNN said yesterday that when Oprah did this in 2008, she may have accounted for more than 1 million votes that Barack Obama got that otherwise would never have been cast. These are people who were probably just going to stay home. But when Oprah went to their door and asked them to vote and asked them to vote for Barack Obama, they ran to the polls. She's doing the same thing in Georgia. Do you think it's going to have any effect?
You know, just for the sake of Brian Kemp not winning, I hope it does. but let's be clear about who Brian Kemp is. Brian Kemp isn't just the Secretary of State currently who's actively suppressing votes. He was actually sued by, I think it was Election Justice in 2016 for the exact same thing, for doing the exact same thing, and he lost that lawsuit. So what he's doing now is actually the very same thing that he was sued for and lost a year or 2 years ago. So how he's able to legally get away with this and be allowed to do this is so far beyond me. But I think it just speaks to the moral bankruptcy of the entire GOP and everyone who's willing to vote for them in the face of knowing that this man has done this. But on the flip side of that, the fact that people are so dismayed and disinterested and disconnected from politics that it takes Oprah Winfrey to get them excited to go out and vote, that's a problem. I get that it's cute and I get that it's funny, and it's great if she is able to garner the kind of boost in voter participation that's needed for Kemp to lose. But that's also a terrible indictment on Democratic politics. And Abrams has some pretty good policy positions, but I think that's still an indictment against a weak Democratic Party platform.
There was a piece in the New York Times today, too, saying essentially the same thing, and saying that in Georgia specifically, Stacey Abrams, who would be the first Black woman elected governor anywhere in America, has done something differently than other left wing female candidates. And that's that she's not pulling any punches. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, the 28-year-old who beat Joe Crowley, the incumbent from Queens in the Bronx, said that she actually had been pulling punches because she didn't want any pushback from voters. She didn't want to be accused of instigating party infighting. Stacey Abrams did not do that. Stacey Abrams came out swinging. The Democrats ended up lining up behind her. She was able to woo suburban voters and moderate Democrats, as well as white working class liberals. And she won her nomination. Now this race is tied at 48-48. Doesn't get any closer than that. But she thinks that that's a formula to win. I wanted to say also that what we're also looking at is essentially the same situation in the state of Kansas. So we haven't really talked about the race in Kansas, at least the gubernatorial race in Kansas. Sam Brownback is the incumbent governor. He's not running for re-election. He's term limited. Brownback sort of became famous or infamous, depending on your point of view, because he's so deeply conservative that he slashed the budget, slashed taxes. So Kansas has the lowest taxes anywhere in America. It also has the worst schools, the worst roads, and the worst hospitals. And there's been flight of teachers to states surrounding Kansas. They're actually like commuting to Missouri to teach, or commuting to Iowa, just because they don't make any money. So Brownback is term limited. And the Republican nominee is the current Secretary of State, Kris Kobach. And Kobach got himself in a little bit of hot water because at the beginning of the Trump administration, he said quite publicly that his words, millions of illegal aliens voted for Hillary Clinton. Okay, that was just simply not true. There was an investigation, and it was found that there were two people who voted illegally, one in Texas and one in Iowa, one Democrat, one Republican. They were both prosecuted. He has kept this up, that there are millions of illegal aliens, his words, that voted. Again, it's just a lie, but he's running on this lie to be governor of Kansas. So Laura Kelly is the Democratic candidate in Kansas, and she's got this race tied 47-47. It's been many, many years since Kansas had a Democratic governor, but Kobach coming on the heels of Brownback may be enough to flip this seat.
I think so, especially since in Kansas, the people who are left in the state who haven't made an exodus because the economy is so horrible because of those tax cuts have not experienced the economic growth that was promised. That was supposed to come from all of these tax cuts. And if Laura Kelly continues, if she's done a good job campaigning, playing on the failure of Brownback's policies, as well as Kobach's blatant lies, I think she's got a path to win this. And that's encouraging.
You know, interestingly, one of the things that Kobach has had to deal with is during the Republican primary, he was fined $26,000. By a federal judge, and the judge said that this was for, quote, contemptuous behavior, unquote, in a voting rights case. And it's because Kobach, oh yeah, just like we're seeing in Georgia, is actively trying to suppress the vote. So something that I think everybody is going to have to take a close look at. Let's move over to Montana and talk about the Senate race. We didn't talk about this race much until just a couple of weeks ago. Donald Trump has made 4 trips to Montana in the last 2 weeks to campaign for John Tester's opponent. John Tester, of course, is the incumbent Democrat. Matt Rosendale is the state auditor and a former developer from Maryland. He moved to Montana in 2002 and is considered a newcomer because he's only been there for 16 years. He was on Fox News the other day, and he was asked about this newcomer label, and he claims to be a Montanan. Tester has been born and raised in Montana, lived his entire life in Montana, except when he was in the military. He's a rancher, a cattle rancher, and he calls Rosendale a carpetbagger. Now, on Fox News, Rosendale admitted that until recently, even though he was living in Montana, he was voting in New Jersey, where he's originally from.
Wow.
Yeah. So it looks like that may have slammed the brakes on his run against Tester. Now, the only real issue that the Republicans have against Tester is that when he was the top Democrat on the Veterans Affairs Committee almost 2 years ago, he's the one who blocked the nomination of Dr. Ronny Jackson as the president's choice to be Secretary of Veterans Affairs. Jackson was the White House doctor. He was also purported to be an alcoholic and a womanizer. He was unqualified to be the Secretary of Veterans Affairs, and he ended up withdrawing his nomination. For whatever reason, Trump took that very personally, and that's been the issue in this race. Is that enough to beat Tester?
I don't know if that's enough to beat Tester, especially now that you have Tester, who realizes that he has to appeal to the Trump base in his state that voted in double digits for Trump by distancing himself from his own party, which is what he's done when he's come out and said that, you know, look, the Democrats have they botched the Kavanaugh debate. I actually think Tester might squeeze this one. I think he might squeeze a win out here. I don't think that his opponent has much to beat him with. I think the revelations of him voting in New Jersey are enough to really just turn voters off.
I agree. You know how Montanans are, and a lot of people in Western states are like this. They're very proud of their state, and they don't believe that you can just move to their state and then call yourself a resident or a permanent resident of that state. You have to sort of be born into it, and it's weird. It's like that in West Virginia as well, but that's just how it is.
Yeah, and I think the fact that this guy he chose to vote in New Jersey. I know that the people of Montana, just the fact that it's New Jersey, you know, has such a, it just leaves a taste in their mouth like, oh, he's one of those, you know, elite northern liberal types of, yeah, that's not going to go over well.
It reminded me of this commercial from the 90s about, it was a salsa commercial, and it was these cowboys sitting around a campfire, and they're talking about salsa, and the salsa's no good. And so one of them looks at the jar and he says, "This was made in New York City." And everybody else says, "New York City?" Right. Well, it's the same thing here. This guy's from New Jersey, and he's calling himself a Montanan? Come on. I think Tester's going to pull this out. I want to look at some of the House races, Jackie, before we move around to the bigger name races around the country. But there have been a lot of pieces, in outlets like Politico, the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Hill newspaper, talking about broader trends and momentum in the battle for the House of Representatives. Now, I told you a week ago that I had a conversation with a senior Republican strategist, close ties to the White House, who said that their original polling showed the Democrats winning the House by 2 to 8 seats. Last week, he said that the momentum had shifted and they believed that they were going to hold the House by 2 to 8 seats. I think he's wrong. I'm looking at polls all across America, and granted, they're public polls. They're not internal polls, but these public polls show that blue wave coming back. The Cook Political Report said day before yesterday that if the election were held today, and it practically will be, the Democrats are competitive in 65 seats currently held by Republicans. 65 seats. They only need to win 23. And it seems to me, with the national mood, what it is, 23 seats ought to be easy. On top of that, there's already been redistricting in Pennsylvania. There's been redistricting in Texas. And the court case is pending on redistricting in North Carolina. I think this is the Democrats to lose. Let me make two more points. Number one, the Democratic National Committee announced yesterday that it had raised more money so far this year for a midterm election than it raised 2 years ago in the year of a presidential election. I think that is absolutely dramatic.
That's dramatic, and it's also very telling of how high the stakes are for the Democrats in this midterm election, and the kind of rhetoric and the kind of machine they're up against with the GOP. I mean, this is what the GOP is good at, right? They're good at ideology and campaigning and sticking to their message throughout every election. And GOP voters are known for coming out and voting in every election. So the Democrats have had to do much better at what they've not been very good at in between presidential elections. But this is how I know that there is no red wave, I don't think, that is going to crash the Democrats retaking the House. All of this bluster and rhetoric and just racist, xenophobic tweets and announcements that Trump is making about this migrant caravan and sending troops to the southern border, that's his October surprise. That's what this is. He's not doing this because this group of people actually pose any kind of threat to entering the United States. He's doing this to further compel GOP voters and independent voters who are on the fence, who might swing toward Republican, to come out and vote in the midterm elections, because he's hoping those people can swing these 23 seats to the Republicans, to the GOP. I don't think that's going to happen.
Your mention of a red wave is important because that's what Donald Trump said just a couple of weeks ago, that there was going to be a red wave, and everybody sort of laughed. Well, somebody in the White House leaked a memo on Monday, a 3-page memo written by White House political director Bill Stepien, bluntly warning that the Republicans are going to lose the House of Representatives. He says here, that, I'm quoting from the memo, "House Republicans' goal this year is simply to minimize losses." That's it. They're not talking about winning anything. Just try not to lose.
No. And you know, this whole October surprise business that Trump is fomenting with the migrants right now, it is not only going to not deliver the House to the Republicans, it's also going to backfire in regard to actually what's going to happen at the border. I mean, that's another longer conversation, but this is not going to be pretty. And it's going to be a terrible stain on him and his already badly stained presidency. And it's going to be a terrible stain on the GOP, too.
It's going to be very, very tough. So I'm interested in talking about some of these races that were just not supposed to be competitive and all of a sudden are. You remember former South Carolina Governor Mark Sanford. Sanford was caught by a reporter cheating on his wife. He went into political exile for a couple of years, ran for the House of Representatives. He won in a very conservative and Republican district. And then, shockingly, he lost the Republican primary this year to a woman named Kate Arrington. She goes by Katie Arrington. And it was because the president tweeted about Sanford just in the final hours of the election, the primary election. And so Sanford lost. Well, Katie Arrington is an extremist, and people are realizing that she's an extremist. And all of a sudden, she's tied with the Democrat. Now, the same thing is happening in places like Orange County, California. Representative Steve King, who's a notorious racist from Northwestern Iowa, he's in the race of his life. All over the country, yeah, we're finding Republicans who've never really had serious challengers ever, and all of a sudden they're tied or they're barely ahead in their races. Those are the races that are going to tell us if there's going to be a blue wave or not. If when the polls close in the East, and some of these endangered Republicans begin to lose, it's only going to get worse as polls close farther and farther west.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, and when you talk about people like King, I think it's interesting that King had to say something just blatantly, openly, just offensively, deplorably racist for people to finally say, oh, he's a disgusting person and we can't support him anymore. And that includes sponsors and such. But these are people who have always been saying problematic, troubling, racist things. So I think the extremism of the Republican Party is pushing these politicians who have always had problematic track records and held to problematic ideology to be more comfortable with being really honest about what they really think. And so now people are looking at them and saying, oh, my God, did we always support these people? I don't think we can do that anymore. Now, there are plenty of people who are still voting for them. Plenty of people are still voting for them because they're perfectly happy with the way they think and what they say. But there are some people in the GOP, some GOP voters who are questioning who they've been supporting, finally. So it will be interesting to see how these particular races end up on Tuesday.
Well, one race that I'm going to be watching maybe all night is the Texas Senate race between Ted Cruz and Beto O'Rourke. We've been talking about this a lot over the last 6 months or so. A number of polls were released this week showing Cruz up by 3 points, and that's among likely voters, 50 to 47. That's Emerson College. Quinnipiac shows him up 51-46. That's Cruz up 51-46. That's 5 percentage points among likely voters. Both of those polls are within the margin of error. And then there's another one, another Emerson College poll that shows him up 47-42. Also within the margin of error. I think Ted Cruz is probably going to win this race, but my goodness, it's going to be close. And it shows that with the right candidate, Texas is within reach for the Democrats.
Yes. Yes, I do think so. Unfortunately, I agree with you, John. I think Cruz is going to win this race, but not by much, just by the skin of his teeth. And you're right. O'Rourke has displayed, like a lot of the new more progressive Democratic candidates have shown, the winning strategy for the Democrats going forward. And you couple that with actual policy, with actual policy platforms that will benefit all people, and they can get out on the stump and explain how these policies will benefit all people, then we're going to talk about a real blue wave. Until then, I think that Texas is going to be one of those tough, just near misses for the Democrats, but it's a lot to build on.
I think you're exactly right. I want to go now to a tight race in upstate New York. This is one everybody's pretty much ignored. This is a congressional race, the 27th congressional district in New York. It's outside of Buffalo. It's represented by a conservative Republican named Chris Collins. Collins was indicted this summer on multiple felony charges of insider trading. He says he's innocent and he's going to trial. The Justice Department says that they have enough for a conviction, and he's still winning this race. The latest poll has him beating the Democrat 44-40. I think that that's interesting. It's not necessarily important, but it's interesting. And the New York Times goes on to say, and this is even more interesting, despite the tight race, Democrats have not invested much money here, in part because strategists believe that even if the Democrat wins the seat, he would be unlikely to win re-election in 2020. I think that's just hilarious. The seat is so Republican that they're just going to give it to the felon because the felon's going to win anyway.
Yeah, never mind. We're never going to win that one really anyway. So let's just let him have it. Just what a...
I got a kick out of it.
Therein lies the problem with the Democratic Party.
We have a few minutes left, Jackie. I want to talk about some Senate races. Joe Donnelly, the endangered Democrat from Indiana, made a bonehead mistake this week. He misused the word butt, B-U-T, and he did it in such a stupid way. It's a totally unnecessary controversy. He was giving a speech this week, and he's talking about inclusion, racial and ethnic inclusion in the state, in his campaign, in his office. And here's what he said, quote, "Our state director is Indian American, but he does an amazing job."
Oh, no.
And then he says, "Our director of all constituent services, she's African American, but she does an even more incredible job than you can imagine. So what did he mean by that? He tried to clarify it later. It says here, Donnelly followed that bizarre phrasing with a sentiment about inclusiveness and diversity. He said, it isn't their race or their religion. It's the incredible person that they are. But at the same time, they have to have a chance. They have to have an opportunity. And that's my responsibility. And I've done it in every office I've had. And I've done it in every campaign I've had, because my campaigns and our Senate office should reflect the face of Indiana. That's great. But that word "but" is what everybody focused on. And it's actually had an effect in the polls. Now, this race is practically tied. And now Republicans think that they've got a chance to just yank it right out from under him. Joe Biden, the Washington Post is comparing this gaffe to Joe Biden, who said recently, and here's a quote, in Delaware, the largest growth of population is Indian Americans moving from India. You can't even go into a 7-Eleven or a Dunkin' Donuts unless you have an Indian accent. And I'm not joking, unquote. Now, you could say, well, that's Joe Biden. He makes idiotic comments like that. But this may be enough to throw the race to the Republicans.
No, no. Listen, John, let me tell you something. I am a technical writer by trade. And if you have a campaign staff and no one is proofreading your speeches, you deserve whatever you get for making a mistake this stupid. This is just this. If Donnelly loses this race because of this gaffe, he deserves to, because this is a simple grammatical error that any high school student who paid attention in grammar and in English class would have caught.
Totally.
So for a seasoned, I'm guessing, well-educated politician to make those mistakes, those comments, not just once, but twice.
Yeah.
And no one caught it. No one caught it. No one on his staff caught it. I don't feel bad for him. I just really don't.
Jackie, we've got about 45 seconds left, and I want to use that last 45 seconds to talk very quickly about the Ohio governor's race. This is a rematch between Richard Cordray, the Democrat, and Mike DeWine, the Republican. Cordray is a former Obama administration official. Mike DeWine is the state's attorney general. They're both running for governor. And of all issues, it looks like this race, which is tied, is coming down to the issue of opioid abuse and the opioid epidemic, which is just terrible in Ohio. Ohio is one of the worst states for opioid deaths. They've taken completely opposite positions. Cordray wants to spend money instead of locking up drug users to treat them. And DeWine wants to lock them up and treatment should be their problem. I just want to point out, and we don't have to talk about it at any length or in any detail. I just want to point out about it that this is an unusual race, that they're usually bashing each other on other things. But this one is about heroin and fentanyl and opioid addiction. And we're going to have to see where this race goes. It's 48-48. Well, we're going to have to leave it there, Jackie. We were joined from Washington by Jacqueline Luqman. She is the co-editor-in-chief of Luqman Nation. And you can check out their live stream every Thursday night at 9 p.m. on Facebook. So stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We have a lot more coming up in the next hour.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.